So now, let's move on to the reason why you're here. I'm sure none of you came for the AGM. It is a real privilege and a pleasure to introduce Dr. Joan Oates to you, though I'm sure you need very little introduction to her. I first came across her work when I was just beginning to think about moving into Mesopotamian studies. I read her beautiful book on Babylon, which has now been through three editions. And I think that book, although I think she first wrote it in the 1970s, and has really stood the test of time and shows how extraordinarily well Joan is able to communicate the fascination and the complexity of the study of ancient Iraq to absolute beginners such as I was, without compromising the integrity of the evidence. And then later on, I used her very interesting and pioneering work on the study of accounting tokens in prehistoric Mesopotamia. Again, the other end of the communication spectrum, a very technical academic piece of work, but then, just like Babylon, very much stood the test of time. Many of you too also know her, the book that she co-wrote with her very long-term research and personal partner, David Oates, Joan's husband, and the book on Nimrud, one of the Institute's best-selling publications, I think that's fair to say, which encapsulates a lot of Joan and David's work together on the city of Nimrud over many, many decades. I could also mention the publications of Tel Brak, which she has been steering for several years now and is still actively working on, very impressively. So that gives you a little flavour of the huge range of archaeological and historical work that Joan has been engaged with, both in the excavation and communication. But I think also the other thing that many of us, many people here and many people all over the world have valued Joan for is her teaching. Not just British students at Cambridge, but I think also in particular your commitment to educating Iraqi students, I think is a really highly significant contribution to Iraqi archaeology. So tonight we're going to invite Joan to turn the clock back a little bit and to tell us some of her memories and to show us some of her photographs of her time working in northern Iraq in the 1950s, and in particular the times around the work, the fun times as well as the work times, and all the people that she worked with and enjoyed life with in Iraq, in northern Iraq in the 1950s. I give you Joan Oates, FBA. Thank you very much.
It's been actually quite a nice time for me to have had to look back at all of the pictures that I do have of Iraq in the 1950s. And I hope that you will enjoy not what I'm going to say today, but the pictures that go back to that sort of level. And after the lecture, we shall be drinking the yearly toast to the Malouins. And for me, this toast is especially relevant, for it was Max who actually sent me to Baghdad, without which, of course, I would certainly not be giving this lecture. In 1950, I'd been a student of Dorothy Garrod, a Paleolithic expert, and of course the first woman professor in Cambridge. And I very much enjoyed talking to her. Is it not? But I decided after a year that if I had to write a thesis, I would much prefer the Neolithic. So in the autumn, I was sent to see someone I'd never heard of. It was a name, funny name, Max Malouin. And at that time, the Institute of Archaeology, of course, was in a lovely house in Regent's Park with Gordon Child as the director. Although nothing of Malawan. I had never heard of him before. He certainly knew nothing of me. But he simply said, you must go to Baghdad. You must stay in the British school. Barbara Parker will look after you. She'd never heard of me either. And that was that. Off I went. Post-war travel was, of course, very much slower than now, but unquestionably much more interesting. In fact, I feel sorry for those of you who are students now, simply getting on and off airplanes. In 1950, a long time ago, the cheapest journey for a student to go to Baghdad involved a train to Paris and then on to Marseille, where one enjoyed the cheapest Greek ship sailing to Beirut. In fact, at that time, it was easy to buy tickets for the whole route from actually in London. I don't think one could do it now. The sea journey itself involved 10 very pleasant days on the Mediterranean, with lengthy stops at 8 or 9 ports, and eventually we got to Beirut. In fact, the whole trip made quite a pleasant holiday. In those days, unless one had a car, of course, from Beirut to Baghdad required two days on this lovely Nairn Desert bus, which went over the coastal mountains and then followed no more than a desert track along the pipeline all the way to the Euphrates. These buses had been designed and built by two New England brothers, but though they were splendid in a sandstorm, not the brothers, but the bus, before descending onto the desert, we became stuck in snow, believe it or not, in one of the Lebanese mountain passes. So it took rather more than the two days to get to Baghdad. Yet, to my great surprise, Barbara Parker was actually waiting at the bus station. She was one of those lovely people who could do the impossible with ease, but not simple things at all. The school accounts caused her a great deal of pain. The British school at that time was in one of the many lovely Turkish-type houses along the banks of the Tigris. This is not our house, but it was our next-door neighbor, and the Beit Melik Ali, the residence of a man who had briefly been king in Saudi Arabia, hence the name of the house. When the Malawans arrived in February, Agatha took over the river balcony where she ate her breakfast every morning, and I had already discovered that the school had a marvelous library, which I very much hope has survived in Baghdad. I don't know where it is, actually. Is it? Good. In later years, Agatha found a much larger house also on the river where David and I and our children lived very happily, though through much of the very pleasant 1960s as well. There is Agatha on the porch eating her breakfast. When I was first in Baghdad, there was still a boat bridge in the northern part of the city. This is not the one in Baghdad, it's one further south, but it was this type of bridge. And there was a fascinating place simply because of the great degree of interesting things of this type. The souk was also a splendid place to wander about. And the copper souk was extremely noisy, but very interesting. This is the interior of the house that the Institute was staying in. It's Barbara Parker herself, later Lady Malawan, standing on the balcony, and the jarjeams that you can see being aired around the courtyard were what we wrapped our bedding in when going to Nimrud. But I am jumping ahead a bit because I haven't been asked to go to Nimrud yet. But they were, the Malawans were coming, and everyone was getting ready to go to the north. In the end, Max said, "Would you like to come to Nimrud?" And I had no idea about whether I would do anything or not, but I said, "Yes, of course." And I joined the ladies going to Nimrud. That was Agatha, Barbara, and myself. And we traveled overnight on the train to Mosul, carrying our bedding, all of our bedding, wrapped up in these bright jarjeems. Agatha, of course, loved shopping in the souk and had plenty of money to spend, and thus there was never a shortage of jarjeems. Max and our excavation driver, who was a very tall Christian named Petros, drove to Nimrud by way of Kirkuk, where Max could make his yearly demands on the IPC, the Iraq Petroleum Company, in Kirkuk. His tactic was to ask for all the visible machines whether or not they might prove useful in Nimrud. And I'm not exaggerating on that one. In fact, he seemed to try to borrow every large machine he could see. The penalty was having to entertain the IPC wives, some of whom only wished to see Agatha Christie. Agatha herself was, of course, always the focus of interest, but it was very trying for her at a number of times because at that time she was actually a very shy person. And on Fridays, the IPC ladies descended on us, and we had to give them lunch, and poor Agatha had to sit and be stared at. One of the most unusual features of the landscape around the petrol fields of Kirkuk is the Baba Gurgur, which has been burning at least from classical times, and where this ordinary feature is mentioned. And it's one of the features that, of course, you don't see if you go on the train. So in later years, when my husband was working in Iraq as well, we used to drive through Kirkuk on the way to the north. My intention this evening is to show you some of the countryside as it was in the 1950s. One of the most striking changes, of course, has been the loss of the fields and fields of wildflowers. Sorry. My daughter typed some of this for me, and I think I'll put it down for a moment, because obviously these are not poppies in the fields. This is Nimrud itself, looking from the north to the ziggurat. And that standing on top of the ziggurat and watching the enormous number of workmen who Malouin happily engaged. And they are in this picture working in the palace and are in the, more or less, in the courtyard with the throne room just behind. And as you can see on the left-hand side, there is our nice dig house and the tents that we slept in with those jarjeems and other blankets that came up on the train. And the, nothing to point with, but on the right, slightly beyond the people, is the Northwest Palace, where a lot of the, well, a large number of the slabs in the British Museum have come from this particular building. It was a lovely place to work, and we didn't mind sleeping in the tents, which you can see, and the food, thanks to Agatha, was absolutely delicious. My intention this evening is to show you some of the countryside, generally, but we have to see Agatha before that. On the left of the picture, and Barbara Parker is taking a picture on the tell with the wonderful camera that we did have at that time. But it usually took about six small boys to help her set everything up and take the picture as well, as one of them had to be in the picture and the rest of them had to hold the black cloth over her. And it was really quite a venture. My intention this evening is to show you some of the countryside as it was in the 1950s, and the most striking change, of course, has been, at least to me, the loss of the fields of wildflowers. There are virtually none now, and certainly in northeast Syria, where I've been working lately, the wildflowers are going or have gone. But in the 1950s, you can see what the tell looked like, even where there'd been excavation, with poppies spread all over. Very beautiful spring. Agatha wandered around the fields around the tell on one occasion and came back with this many tulips in her hand, just having picked them in the tell off the tell. Just one little picture of excavation at Nimrud, which I thought you might find entertaining, which is Agatha lying up on the edge. And I don't think she actually had that brick actually on her legs, but it looks that way. And you will see some of our picnicking photographs later on. And Max is never found sitting down. He stands for everything. And Agatha, who was, of course, a much larger and, I would have thought it would be have been more difficult for her to sit down. She could always get down on the ground and up again, but I never saw Max sitting on the ground at all. And you will see some more of this in a few minutes. This is the Fort Chalmeneser that my husband and I spent a great deal of time on, and there is no time to examine a building of this size, but it was the where the military materials were kept. But at the back corner of the middle of that wall, there was another throne room, and this is the this is the throne base, which is in a room that is about 12 meters high. And it was such a splendid piece that we decided it had to go to Baghdad. And what do you do? You get back and do what Max has always done and ask the IPC. And they sent two of their largest trucks. In fact, they were the largest trucks in the country because it was a two-piece throne base. And there is the IPC, the petroleum company, with one of its lifting gear, lifting the very heavy stone base into the truck, which they also lent us at that time. And one of the interesting things in this was that when the trucks got to the museum in Baghdad, David had a telegram, because there were no telephones then. You always exchanged telegrams. And the museum was saying, we can't get this through the door. You have to come down and help us. And I'm afraid my husband replied that he got it out of the building and they could get it into the museum. That was how our bread came every day, delicious. That was how our water came, also delicious, out of the Tigris. And the donkeys were paid the same rate as the ordinary workmen for working during the day. And what happened was that it was about a mile and a half down to the Tigris. And when the water arrived, it was, of course, poured into that large jar that you can see on the left of this picture beside the guard's house, dropped through to the little jug below, and then went into the kitchen where it was boiled, and we had nice boiled water from the Tigris. At the end of one season, my husband and I had been left behind to pack up the house. Max and Agatha always went away before they'd done anything at all, and I can't blame them, but that's we were left on our own. And I went into the kitchen to say I was rather thirsty, and which was the bottle of boiled water. And the two kitchen boys looked at me and said, what did I mean? And apparently, for the whole season, we had been drinking water straight from the Tigris. None of us was ill. Now, we will leave Nimrud, because really this is, I hope to show you some of the lovely places that have been overpopulated and destroyed and so forth since we were there in the 1950s. And this is the river going through, you wouldn't believe it if you've seen Nineveh now, through the site of Nineveh. And it's all built over completely. But it was Agatha's favorite swimming place, and we used to go there for picnics on Fridays. When I was, the very first season that I was in Nimrud, two American film producers suddenly appeared on the site and said they wanted to go to see Sennacherib's dam, not the dam, to, what is the big, yes, thank you, in Bavian. And Max said, why don't you go with them? You know, it's a long way to get to this place. And I said, yes, I'd love to go. And Barbara, being sensible as ever, gave me her fedora, the heavy sheepskin coat. And I thought, I don't know what, it's hot. I don't know what I need this for. But it went with me in the car. And to cut a long story short, when we got nearly to the place that we were intending to arrive, the villagers looked at this very smart American car and said, it'll never get along that road. So the two American film producers hired the car that you see. And, of course, it got, the rear axle was caught on a stone. And there we were in the countryside with nobody able to get the car off. And the police came to the rescue and brought some horses. And I'd never ridden a horse before. And we rode 4 miles to Chinnis, the village by Bavian, where the sculptures are. And it was quite an extraordinary episode. There is the car on the rock. There were the nice people who rescued us and brought the horses and then gave us tea on the just outside the village. And there was just the rest of the tea party. And that was what we were going to see. That is a drawing of this cliff sculpture. By the time we got to Bavian, it was getting dark. And there was no choice. We had to stay overnight in the village. And there was a house with two rooms, the men's room and the ladies' room. And I was in the men's room, of course, because that was a polite thing to do to visitors. And it was the first year I was at Nimrud. My Arabic was virtually nil, but I could understand a bit. And Kurdish, totally nil. And by the time I had heard 3 hours of discussion about what they were going to do with me overnight, I was beginning to get to understand what they were saying. And the interesting thing to me, coming new to the country, was that it would have been an insult to put me as a guest with the women. And therefore, I had to sleep. There were two rooms in the house, and there were about 9 men in this room, and they all rolled up in their farewells in the evening, and but the only problem I had was that there was one fanus, a little lamp, and they wanted always to put it in front of my face because I was the guest, but I didn't want a light in front of my face, and we didn't sleep very well. And had I not been given Barbara's fedora as we left, I would have had a problem. But all it was quite easy because I just rolled up in this and lay on the floor and put the light back every time it came in my way, and actually got some sleep. We always went out for a lovely picnic on Fridays. It was one of Agatha's favorite things, and we saw a lot of the countryside. One of our favorite places was the monastery at Alcoche, and this is the entrance to where the monastery was. And Agatha, we had 2 cars. Agatha hired a taxi, which was very comfortable. And if you'd been good for the week, you sometimes got invited to ride with her in the taxi. And then most of the rest of us had to sit in the back of a lorry, the dig truck. And on this occasion, I think I'd actually got into the taxi with Agatha. But one had to walk through this gap to get to just at the top, you can see the edge of the monastery. And we climbed up to the monastery, and we looked around, and there it is a bit better, and looked at the man inscribing a date over the door, which was not the date that was being used in the country at the time, and no sign of Agatha yet. So we all turned around and went down. And she was still coming through that lengthy place where you had to climb over the rocks to get through. And she quite cheerfully turned around and walked back without having seen the monastery at all. Upper right-hand corner is where we were. And you can see where Nineveh is some distance away. At least I hope you can in this. One of the other places that we spent some time going to was this dam, and there is a village there. And in about 1975, I took a swan tour to Iraq, which was possible at that time, and we came back to this village to look at the dam, and there was no village. Well, this was 1975, and so I was telling the tour about the site, and then sent them off to look at there was no village at all in 1975, and I gave my little spiel about the dam, and then wandered over because I knew where the village was, and I could not find a trace of anything. Not only had all the people been taken and presumably shot, there was nothing left to say that there had ever been a village there. The spring, as I was saying earlier, the spring was incredibly beautiful in a lot of the north in Iraq at this time, with modern fertilizers and agriculture, of course, all of these beautiful wildflowers have gone, but this particular field, we all stopped and jumped out of the car to take photographs, was simply an incredibly beautiful, it was like a rug, but spring flowers. And this is what you were looking at, but I've never seen a field like that anywhere else. So one of the things that has happened in Syria as well is that the poppies that we knew around the cell have gone, and modern fertilizers may be a good thing to have, but the poor, beautiful flowers suffer. One of our favorite Friday picnics was to go out to various of the I was trying to think which village this is. It's one of the Yazidi villages. You probably know about the Yazidis. They're always said to be devil worshippers, but it's simply that they avoid the word or any word that sounds like it with a sheen, just to protect themselves from the devil. And this is one of the Kurdish villages near this was the Yazidi festival day, and when we were actually in the village, we saw what we thought was the Black Prince, and we'd heard about this, but I didn't believe that it was a real person being tumbled into a little brick or a little stone building. So we did establish that there was such a person, but it was a very jolly day for everybody else. And everybody was in very, these are all Yazidis. It's a Yazidi village. And more Yazidis. Weddings were also a focus of the photography on the part of all of the Nimrud dig staff. And there's also a band of this sort. This is at the festival. And I just lost one. It'll come back, I think, in a minute. We also went into Kurdistan, which was extremely beautiful country then, with very narrow little roads. And the reason everybody has stopped here, you can see Max Malawan at the back of the Jeep, the Land Rover, and my husband on the right. Everybody was down. You can see they were taking a photograph, and this is what they were taking a photograph of a sweet little boy with this extraordinary sheepskin with a sort of stick across his shoulders to keep it sticking out. We went to Kurdistan a number of times, which was absolutely beautiful country, of course, and very not built up at all, and this is one of the roads that went into the depths of Kurdistan. And of course we always stopped and had a picnic, and you remember Max standing up in that digging picture. It's Max in the corner standing up here. And in the middle, it's Agatha sitting down again. And as I say, she can get up. Max never sits down. And this was one of the picnics that we enjoyed on these Friday outings. This is the road to Rwandu's Gully Alibeg, where a British engineer in the 1920s spent 4 years dealing with several rather fighting groups of workmen to build a road through the Rwandu's Gorge and on to the Persian border. 4 years, and there is a book that you can read about this. And I was thinking when the University of Cambridge went to look at Shanidar Cave that I would go along just to see this road again. And I was very disappointed. I mean, there is the road. It's very narrow. It was beautiful. And now it's a four-lane highway with restaurants and hotels even. They must have blasted an enormous amount of rock away, which was rather sad. That's the 1950s. Weddings were also a focus of the photography, the dig photography, and this is the bride on the front horse that you can see all of, being ridden to her husband-to-be for the wedding, whatever reception there is. That's a rather better picture. Very colorful and rather fun to see. This is the site that my husband and I spent some years digging in the 1960s. We'd moved out of the 1950s. And this is Tel Rimah in the north of Iraq. And we thought that we would find the usual large tell with a lot of buildings that are important buildings, and then houses in the outer town. But you can see there's a wall around the outer town, and there's a quite high tell in the middle. But it didn't. And this is my children and the little children they played with sitting on top of the tell. And again, the tulips and the flowers that are incredibly beautiful is still in the 1960s. That is the tell after it's been, as you can see, dug rather a lot. But it turned out to be something that we had not expected at all, which was a single building that occupied the whole of the top of the tell. And there was a triple staircase on the right-hand side of this picture, running up to the temple. This is our camp at Tel Rimah. And that is Heidi Lloyd's watercolor of the building that we were actually digging on the top of the tell. And it's a little imaginative, but it's roughly that sort of building. It was an extraordinary place, and there were 270 columns of mud brick that were built in the way that you can see partly here. There were some of them represented date palms, and then some of them were just as you see in the picture here. It's an extraordinary building, and we know only one other building like that. That's a palm tree on the entrance part of the building. At Tel Rimah, we found large quantities of glass and faience materials. And this is perhaps one of the most pleasant pieces that we unearthed there. And a splendid little goblet where this is glass, where the decoration has been swagged in to the wet, or at least not dried, cup. That is another method of making vessels from glass. And one of the more interesting things at Telerima was the a small Laetitiarian shrine on the top of the tell. There was no Laetitiarian shrine village there, but there was a shrine with I've come back to another picnic, showing you again Max standing up and Agatha in the blue dress, lying on the ground, sitting on the ground, Barbara the other side of, I think it's David Stronach, standing up between them, and Jörn Laeso just beyond Max Mallowan. And I've never understood why Max could never sit down, and why Agatha, who was so large, could actually lift herself off the ground quite easily. This is the same place that you were just looking at. It doesn't look like much of a site at all, but when David and I were first married and went to do our first dig all by ourselves, we went back here because it was a military camp of, and you can see how we had brought the equipment and that were needed and the furniture from Nimrud to dig Ein Sinu, which is one of the few Roman sites that has been excavated in northern Iraq. We had a visit from Freya Stark. I've got it this time. I'm getting old, you can tell. Freya Stark came, and she demanded quite a lot. And we had to take her out hither and thither. And one of the funniest things that happened when we were actually living at this place, the census was being taken for the first time in Iraq. And we could see the census car way down on the plain to the south of us, and the dust behind it. And David was writing a book with an interest in this type of information, and went to the University Library in Cambridge to find whether there was any report on this census. It was the first one in Iraq. And he found a very serious article which was writing about the extraordinary large number of women, babies, female babies, in the steppe of northern Iraq. And of course, we knew exactly what was happening. The men all went to hide because they had to go into the army if they got caught. And all the camps below us, we could see the census car on the steppe beyond us. And it simply was counting women, but there was virtually no men around. And there was another, slightly, I suppose, amusing, but it was difficult at the time. They came and counted us on the dig. And David was obviously the director, and therefore he had to be in charge. And here were all these much older men. I think we'd been married about 6 months by then. And because they were living in tents at Einsiedeln, they had to be counted on the same family. They were all living together, right? So I am wife number one. Barbara Parker was there at the time, so she was wife number two. And then all of the workmen were aged by their pay. The ones paying the most, getting the most pay, were this level of age, and then the boys. I mean, it was extraordinary, and this is the sort of thing that lies behind the unreliable reports that sometimes you get out of this part of the world. As you can see, we have enjoyed all of the work that we have done in Iraq. It was a lovely place to work in, and it provided a lot of interest, not only in terms of the archaeology, but in terms of the people who actually lived there, in what was a very pleasant place to be in the 1950s and even in the 60s. And I finish with another house that Agatha was the person who found the accommodation for the British school in Baghdad and went around and looked at all sorts of things. And the middle house of these three was the British school that was bombed. I think it was on the morning of the Queen's birthday, the British Queen's birthday, in 1987. I think it was about then, a bomb from Iran, or it must have been a missile from Iran. It landed directly on the school. But fortunately, it was not the school anymore, but not very nice for the people who were living there. And David and I went back to Iraq after this, and we went and walked along the bank to see if we could find even a little piece of the old house, and there was absolutely nothing. So that was a lovely place to be, but it ended rather sadly. And living in Iraq was absolutely lovely. There was no difficulty in type of Arab or Christian or whatever. And there were enormous numbers of very talented people, artists and musicians. And it for the 50s and the 60s, it was a very, very pleasant place to live and work. And I'm sorry that most of you probably haven't done that. And it was really an extraordinary life with very friendly and helpful administration in Mosul and Baghdad, very well-trained Shagati workmen, and of course the privilege of digging several of the most interesting, indeed important sites in northern Iraq. Thank you.
Delightful lecture and most beautiful pictures. I'm sure there are members of the audience who will have questions for Professor Oates. Would anyone like to?
Yes, it did get the axle got caught, and what I'd never ridden a horse in my life. And we were, the police brought us horses to take us on to the village, and it was 4 miles, and I didn't fall off. but the car was a local car in 1952, and it was given to us in the village. I mean, we took it back, of course, because the axles were, but it wasn't high enough, because the picture had the car was actually stuck in, it was about 2 miles from the village. A lot of chaps went in and did this. That's why it didn't come out very quickly. I did drive when David wasn't around. I used to take children to school in the Land Rover. But when we first had the Land Rover there, my job was to sit next to him, and if something started happening in the engine, I was to kick the front of the seat, the front of the car, and the holes were
crazy.
She was trying to get on the raft that she wanted to ride down the Tigris from Turkey. She'd been in Turkey, and they wouldn't let her take a raft anyway. So she came to Mosul, and a friend of ours who was the head of the British Council in Mosul was tearing his hair because she was bullying him. And she wanted a raft, and this friend of ours kept telling her that there aren't any rafts at this time of year, so we can't do anything for you. And fortunately, she had her back to the window when the raft went by. And at that point, he decided, this friend of ours, this is when David and I were digging the Roman site, the first one we did together. And the chap who was head of the British Council in Mosul sent Freya out to stay with us. She was muttering about this. David said, tomorrow we have to take you to register you in Sinjar. I mean, this is the right thing to do. I never do that. And she wanted us to take her in the car somewhere. And David said, well, we don't do that until you're registered. But no, she was a bit uppity. But when we did get her to the local officials, we're all sitting around. They all sat in the same room because, of course, they weren't doing anything. They were just sitting and chatting. And she started reciting Persian poems, and her Arabic was very good as well. So, and she had an enormous ruby on her little finger, which we had noticed, of course. And when the officials from the village came back to see her again, and she'd gone, somebody said, where is my grandmother, the millionaire?
That's
true.
after which I will now announce the results of the election. All election by service.
Well, this, of course, is the first lecture for 2013 that the Institute is putting on. I think you'll all agree it was a great treat. I mean, we couldn't have asked for a better start to the year. You began your talk by saying that we would be interested in looking at the pictures, but not at what you have to say. And I think it would be completely wrong not to start by saying we were fascinated by both. It was absolutely wonderful. Of course, these sorts of recollections taking us back to Iraq before the last 30 years of conflict and disaster reminded me very much of first reading Henry Layard's account of Iraq and really getting an insight into the people and the places. And it was, of course, the people and the places, the landscape that you so vividly recollected here for us all. But those of us who haven't been lucky enough to visit northern Iraq, this is a wonderful introduction. It also reminds us, I think, underlines the fact that so much of the modern work that's going on in northern Iraq, the new excavations, the new survey work that's just beginning, rests on the great achievements that were undertaken in the 50s and 60s when you were there. And I think it's also true to say that it takes us back to really what we are all interested in, whether we're reading the texts or the stratigraphy. It's the people and the landscapes of Iraq. And perhaps the most evocative images that you had were really of those flowers, the flowers that we won't be able to see anymore, but you can see on the Assyrian reliefs, and you can see in your slides. So it makes it real and meaningful. And for that alone, deserve the applause that you're about to get. But I want to end this vote of thanks really by saying that, of course, this is just one element, as you all know, of the work that Professor Oates has undertaken in helping us to understand Iraq and the wider Middle East. And I think it's for that, as well as this most fantastic talk this evening, that if I invite you to join me in thanking
the ladies and gentlemen, just a little, a few more minutes of business before we go and have a reception. And then, as Joan reminded us, we will also be drinking a toast this evening to the memory of Dame Agatha and Sir Max Mullen. But first, I am pleased to announce the results of the elections to our Governing Council. There were four candidates standing. The elected members are Adam Stone, Dr. Nelida Fukaro, and Professor Hugh Kennedy. So they will be committing to 3 years of solid work for us. So thank you very much indeed for all four members of the Institute for standing for election. Very, very grateful for all four of you. Before we have our drinks and nibbles, just to tell you about a few upcoming events and publications, and also to remind you, as perhaps you've seen already downstairs, there are copies of Joan and David Oates' book, Nimrud, an Imperial City, Imperial Assyrian City Revealed, which are on for sale downstairs. There are also current newsletters, membership flyers. There are also flyers for the Institute's next publication, which is Ivories from Nimrud, Volume 7, published by Georgina Herman, which will be coming out in May. And finally, I'd like to tell you of a few events that are coming up, either organised by the Institute or co-sponsored by the Institute or of related interest. So it is, of course, coming up to 10 years since the Iraq War, and there are a number of events commemorating that very difficult period of Iraqi history and reflecting on the ongoing consequences of it. Most immediately, there is a free one-day conference at SOAS this Saturday, so the day after tomorrow. If you're on our email list, you would have received an email this morning from Lauren about that, and information, I think, will have
if we have time, appear on the website. At Chatham House, on the Tuesday the 19th of March, BISI is co-sponsoring another event on the same topic. There is that information on the BISI website on that already. That is also free to attend. A rather happier day, we hope, will be on Saturday the 27th of April at the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford, where one of our speakers will again be Professor Oates. And it's a study day called Nimrud, From Mount to Museum, funded by the Arts and Humanities Research Council. And the idea of that day is to think about the ways in which objects that are excavated by archaeologists like Joan turn from things found in the ground, the sorts of scientific, archaeological artefacts from which we can write history, and the sorts of people and processes involved in creating knowledge from things found in the ground. Small charge for that, £5 for BISI members, £10 for other people, but that includes tea and coffee, and I hope a jolly good day. And you can register for that on the website too. So finally, just to say for all of you, I hope you are enjoying our new look website and the ease with which you can do all sorts of things, such as register for events, buy publications, etc. And just to thank Lauren very much for putting behind that. And Erica, you would also like to... Thank you for the reminder, and that's at SOAS as well. Super, thank you very much indeed for that. Okay, so it just remains for me to thank the British Academy, our hosts here, not only tonight, but our permanent hosts with the administrative staff and without whom really we couldn't function. So really to thank them enormously for all their support for us throughout the year, day in, day out. To declare the meeting closed and invite you outside for a reception and a toast to the Malamans. Thank you all very much. And once again, thank you very much. Indeed.